So the numerals are the types of chromosomes. The reason that 2 is a different type of chromosome compared to 1 is that the genes that are contained in chromosome 2 are in control of a totally different set of characteristics compared to the ones in number 1 and so on. All right? But notice that there are 2 number 1s, there are 2 number 2s, and so on, which is true for certain cells, not all cells, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. But the pair number 1 is shown in cartoon form on the left, so we can take a closer look at it. Now, this is one type of chromosome, but it's 2 separate chromosomes, right? This is one chromosome, this is another chromosome. They're both number 1 type chromosomes. And also, not only are they 2 chromosomes, each single chromosome is a replicated chromosome, which is why each individual chromosome is really 2 chromatids that are identical to each other, 2 sister chromatids, in other words, hooked together at a centromere. We've already talked about all of these structures, right? Now, this number 1 on the left is not genetically identical to the number 1 on the right. Close, it has the same kinds of genes, but not necessarily the same versions of genes. Why is it that they are different from each other? Any idea? This could be yours. This is from a human. Why is it that your 2 number 1s are not the same as each other exactly? Yeah. Right. You have 2 parents. We are a sexual species. So one of these chromosomes came from one parent, the other one came from the other parent. That's why they're not identical to each other. They can be very close, but there are going to be some differences. 2, on the other hand, that's a totally different type of chromosome controlling a whole different set of characteristics. Okay. That's just some terminology. Now let's go to slide 3, and I need to give you some more important definitions. These are confusing to a lot of people at first, so listen carefully. There's one definition that is just a symbol. We use N as the symbol. Oh, where's my purple one? Did I put that away? Just N as a variable is the symbol that denotes the number of different kinds of chromosomes that particular species has. All right? Now, I've told you several times before that how many different kinds of chromosomes there are depends on the species. Or I've at least told you that the number of genes... No, I actually told you that the number of chromosomes varies by species. For instance, for humans, there are 23 different kinds of chromosomes. That's why there were 23 pairs of chromosomes in that human karyotype in the previous slide. All right? So N is not necessarily the number of chromosomes you find in a cell. N is the number of different kinds of chromosomes there are. All right. Now that is a totally different definition compared to ploidy. Ploidy also has to do with numbers of chromosomes, but it's a totally different definition. Ploidy refers to how many chromosomes of each type there are in a cell. You see the difference? It's not how many types there are, it's how many of each type there are. And so, in that previous slide, go back to it for just a second, this is a karyotype in which the N is 23. Okay, there's 23 kinds of chromosomes here. That's the N. The ploidy, though, is that there are 2 of each kind. There's 2 number 1s, 2 number 2s, and so on. And so ploidy is the real general term. There are different degrees of ploidy. And we're only going to talk about the two most frequently encountered degrees of ploidy. If a cell has only one of each kind of chromosome, we say that that cell is haploid. And that's not shown here, right? This is not a haploid cell this was taken from. If a cell has two of each, it is diploid. So haploidy and diploidy are 2 degrees of ploidy. Ploidy is the more general term. All right? Notice that di means two, as in diploid. Well, if we look at slide 3 here, what is N? You can cheat and read it, but just look at the picture. What is N for this species, whatever it is? Right. How do you know there are 3 kinds of chromosomes here? Yes, but how do you know what a kind is?
The colors.
No, it's not the colors.
Size,
yes. Notice there aren't 3 colors. There's 2 colors. There's 3 sizes. There's a big version of a chromosome, a medium, and a small. Those are the 3 kinds or types of chromosomes. And that's why N is 3 here. But notice that there's 2 of each. There's 2 number 1s, 2 number 2s, and 2 number 3s. Or 2 big, 2 medium, 2 small. Therefore, the ploidy is diploid. And the overall number of chromosomes in a diploid cell is 2 times N, or 2N. If this were a haploid cell, the total number of chromosomes would simply be N. 1N is just simply N, right? And that's why we call N the haploid number. Even, you know, N is the haploid number no matter whether a cell is haploid or diploid. N is the haploid number for the species. If a cell in the body of a member of that species is diploid, N is still the haploid number, but the diploid cell has 2N chromosomes. Okay? Everyone comfortable with those definitions? Let's go to 4 and start talking about sexual life cycles. We're starting here with humans as an example, although this would be the same for any animal. We're just representative animals. But we start with humans simply because it's easiest to understand ourselves before comparing it to others. The most important thing about this slide, though, is actually true of any sexual species, not just animals, not just humans. Any sexual species has a sexual life cycle that is a generation to generation alternation between 2 important processes. And the processes are shown in the boxes. Fertilization and meiosis. And what I meant by a generation to generation alternation is that it goes back and forth between fertilization and meiosis, and then fertilization again and meiosis again over the generations. Okay? If we're talking about these 2 processes, we better define them both. So some more definitions. I'll start with fertilization, mainly because that is the defining event in a sexual species. That's really what qualifies a species as being sexual. Fertilization is the defining event. But what is fertilization? Well, fertilization is the fusion of 2 unicellular gametes to produce 1 unicellular zygote. The word gamete is a unisex term for sex cell, meaning that there are 2 kinds of gametes, 1 for each of the 2 sexes in the species. And for humans, for instance, the male gamete is called a sperm, the female gamete is called an egg. They have that name for a lot of species, not just humans. But in any case, sperm and egg are gametes. All right? Fertilization is the fusion of those gametes, each of which is an individual cell in its own right, but they fuse to make one cell that is called a zygote. And that is what makes the species sexual, the fact that these two gametes fuse. Now that happens, you know, there's all kinds of other things leading up to that, but really what defines it as sexual reproduction is fertilization. Well, notice that this is how offspring are different from their parents, because each parent is donating some DNA, some chromosomes, to the zygote, and the zygote is therefore a mixture of chromosomes from both parents. This is why the offspring are different from both parents. It's a brand new set of genetic library every time you have a zygote created. And this is why it's successful, at least sometimes, especially in the face of changing environments. But think about what has to happen for that to occur. If a gamete, which has a ploidy, it has a ploidy before it fuses, right? It has whatever its ploidy is. And the other gamete has its ploidy. When you fuse those two to make the zygote now has double the ploidy compared to either of the gametes, because the zygote now has all of the chromosomes from each of the two gametes, one from each parent. In other words, fertilization, for it to happen, doubles the ploidy. And that will quickly get out of hand. We talked about how amazing it is for the DNA to fit in not only a microscopic cell, but an even tinier nucleus within the cell. Well, if you start doubling the amount of DNA every generation, there just is not going to be room after a couple generations. And therefore, if fertilization were the only thing happening in the sexual life cycle, sexual species would quickly go extinct. We wouldn't be around. You see that? You can't keep doubling the amount of DNA and still contain it in cells. So there has to be some other mechanism to deal with this problem of DNA building up. In other words, to deal with the problem of the doubling of ploidy every generation. And that's the other box. Meiosis solves this problem. So we've talked about mitosis already, which is part of cell division in a eukaryote, right? It's specifically the division of the nucleus in a eukaryotic cell. Well, so is meiosis, but things happen differently in meiosis compared to mitosis. Meiosis, though, like mitosis, is division of the nucleus. But this actually brings up another dichotomy. There are two types of cells in a sexual species. Just think of your own body, since you're a sexual species. The two kinds of cells are somatic cells, and germline cells. Now, somatic is a word that means of the body. Soma means body. It's kind of a misnomer because, of course, even the germline cells are part of your body as well. But the reason that they use that word somatic is because the vast majority of the cells making up your body are somatic cells. Almost all of them are. Germline cells are a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of your overall cells. And germline cells are found in gonads, which is another unisex term. Gonad is the primary sex organ in a species, but there are different versions for the two sexes. So in male humans, the gonads are the testes. In female humans, the gonads are the ovaries. Those produce the gametes. That's what gonads do. They're organs that produce gametes. But the kind of cells within those organs that produce gametes are germline cells. All right? Now, for your body, the somatic cells are diploid and the germline cells are diploid. So that's not the difference. The difference between the two is the kind of cell division that can occur in these cells. Somatic cells undergo mitosis only. And so when a somatic cell divides, it just produces two exact copies of itself to replace itself. And now there are more cells. Okay? A germline cell is a somatic, is also a diploid cell, but it undergoes both mitosis and meiosis. In that order. Undergoes mitosis first, and then meiosis. Now, the important thing about meiosis, there's several differences I'll mention, but the reason that it has to exist if a species is going to be sexual is that meiosis cuts the ploidy in half. And this is how it makes up for the problem of doubling the ploidy. If you double it in fertilization and then cut it back in half, you're back to where you started with. And therefore, over the generations, the DNA does not build up in cells. So for humans, for example, each gamete is a haploid gamete. You join those two together in fertilization to produce a diploid zygote. And then in the next generation, that zygote, after it's grown up into another human, can produce haploid gametes. And that's because meiosis cuts the ploidy in half. All right. Now back to this germline cell thing. I said that a germline cell undergoes mitosis first and then meiosis. The reason that it's important to do mitosis first is because there's a tiny, tiny number of germline cells. And whenever a germline cell, which is a diploid cell, undergoes meiosis, haploid cells are created and the original cell no longer exists, right? Which means if you start with a tiny number of germline cells and you get rid of them every time one of them undergoes meiosis, you'll quickly run out of them. So each germline cell, when it's time to divide, will undergo mitosis first, and that produces two identical copies. The original cell's not there, but now there are two to replace it. And then one of those will just hang around and replace the germline cell that was lost. And the other one will go on into meiosis and become gametes. That way you're always keeping that small population of germline cells in your body. Okay, so that the important point here is that fertilization, which has to happen if you're going to have genetic variability in your offspring, if you're going to involve two parents, that is, that's always going to double the ploidy because of the way it works. And therefore, you need meiosis to cut it back in half so that you don't build it up over the generations. Now, let me go to the next slide, which is more sexual life cycles. But these are for the huge groups of eukaryotes. So animals on the left, and that includes us, of course. So this is really just the same one we looked at. Plants in the middle and fungi on the right. Now, there are other sexual eukaryotes besides these three groups, but these are the biggies. Notice what I said before is true. You can see that every sexual species has a life cycle that features an alternation from generation to generation between fertilization and meiosis. It goes back and forth. Therefore, the overall cycle includes two different versions of the species in terms of ploidy. There is a haploid part of the cycle, represented by a cell with N in it, because N is the haploid number. And there is a diploid part of the life cycle, represented by 2N. That's for all sexual species, not just animals. See N and 2N, N and 2N over here as well. And that's just another, that's just a consequence of what we've already said. Fertilization produces the diploid because it brings two cells together. Meiosis produces the haploid because it reduces the ploidy. What's different, really, about these three groups is when it comes to which of the parts of the cell cycle are unicellular and which part are multicellular. All right? Now, for humans, for animals in general, which includes humans, the cycle is dominated by the diploid phase, which is why there's more tan color here than teal. So we live our lives as adults as multicellular diploid animals. And that's why your somatic cells, which are most of your body, are diploid. Because that's what animals do. Now, when you produce a gamete, whether it's a sperm or an egg, that is a human. But it's the haploid version of a human. Every sexual species has a haploid version and a diploid version. And for animals, the haploid version is only ever unicellular. So there's two possibilities for an animal gamete. It's produced as a haploid cell by meiosis, and it either lives however long it does and dies as a haploid cell, one cell, or it joins up with a haploid gamete of the other sex, which is what fertilization is, and it's no longer the same cell anymore. So it still doesn't go on to multicellularity. As soon as you have a zygote, then you're into the diploid stage. And that we start as a single-celled zygote, but then that single-celled zygote undergoes mitosis to become two cells, then four cells, and eventually hundreds of trillions of cells. Okay? Or tens of trillions, at least, for animals. Now, let's go to the other extreme before doing the middle. The kind of the inverse of us animals is what fungi do, at least most species. Their life cycle is dominated by the haploid phase. The haploid phase is the only multicellular part of the life cycle of a fungus. So an adult fungus, its body is made up of haploid cells, unlike us. Now when it comes time for a fungus to produce its gametes, the adult is already made up of haploid cells, right? So it doesn't produce its gametes via meiosis like we animals do. Doesn't make sense for a haploid cell to undergo meiosis because a haploid cell already has the minimum ploidy. You can't cut it in half. Therefore, gametes in a fungus are made simply by mitosis, which produces more haploid cells. Mitosis never changes the ploidy. All right? So gametes from two parents fuse in fertilization just like they do in us. That produces a diploid zygote just like in us. But unlike in us animals, the zygote for a fungus does not undergo mitosis to become multicellular. Instead, the zygote, as a single cell still, quickly undergoes meiosis to become haploid cells, each of which is the beginning of a new fungus. And then each of those haploid cells undergoes mitosis to become multicellular individual fungi. Okay, so the The difference here is that animals have a unicellular haploid stage, a multicellular diploid stage. The fungi have a multicellular haploid stage, a unicellular diploid stage. And the middle one, which is plants, is kind of a combination of the two. In plants, the life cycle is often described as alternation of generations. But be careful with that phrase, because I already used the word alternation earlier. When you describe plants as having an alternation of generations, that alternation has nothing to do with the alternation between fertilization and meiosis. All sexual species, not just plants, alternate between meiosis and fertilization. But in plants, what alternation of generations specifically refers to is that both the haploid and the diploid stage are multicellular. So for a given plant species, there's a diploid version and a haploid version, just like in the others, except that both of them are multicellular. And that's why you have these little pictures here. This is a haploid plant of a certain species. This is a diploid plant of the same species, but it looks different. One is made up of haploid cells, the other made up of diploid cells. And we give these two multicellular stages, or the organisms in them, different names. The gametophyte generation is the haploid phase. Phyte means plant, and gametophyte therefore means gamete-producing plant. So they are multicellular haploid plants that produce gametes, kind of like fungi do. They're already haploid, so they just use mitosis. The diploid stage, which starts with the production of a zygote, but becomes multicellular like us animals, is called the sporophyte generation. Sporophyte means spore-bearing plants, and they produce their spores via meiosis, which turns them into haploid cells. Any questions on those definitions? All right, let's go to six then. Now, the cell that we see on the top is just a fictitious cartoon, but it's some fictitious species. What is N here for this species?
One.
There's one kind of chromosome here, right? Only one size. And the ploidy? No, we don't use numerals for ploidy. It's diploid, right. The ploidy is diploid. So this is an N of one diploid cell, therefore it has 2N total chromosomes. The diploid number is always 2N. 2 times 1 is 2. You wouldn't really see this, right? Because these are unreplicated chromosomes, and like I said before, you wouldn't see it as an individual chromosome until after replication, after the S phase of the cell cycle. All you would really see is chromatin, but it's just drawn for ease of looking at it. This white arrow represents the S phase of the cell cycle, of interphase. And that's why now you still have a diploid cell here, but these chromosomes are now replicated chromosomes. Each one is made up of two identical sister chromatids held together at a centromere. And the colors represent parental origin. So the blue from one parent, the red from the other parent. Okay, now I need to talk about more differences between meiosis and mitosis. And meiosis is more confusing than mitosis for the vast majority of people, which is why it's taught second. Truly understanding meiosis requires you to have a good grasp of mitosis, which you should at this point because you've already been tested on it. We've already been through mitosis. So I'm going to refer back to it, even though I don't have pictures of mitosis. I want you to picture it in your mind, things that we've already looked at. All right, so one difference right away is that mitosis, which we're not looking at here, involves one division event. Meiosis, on the other hand, involves two division events. And that's why the overall process, which is called meiosis, is broken into meiosis 1 and meiosis 2, Roman numerals. Meiosis 1 happens first, and this is really important as well, and make sure you understand this. Tell me if you don't. It's meiosis 1, that division event, that is responsible for the reduction in ploidy, which is what meiosis has to accomplish. That's why it exists. You have to cut the ploidy in half in order to make up for the doubling that occurs in the other part of the cell cycle, fertilization. Well, that occurs right away in meiosis 1. So you might say, if that's the goal, to reduce the ploidy, why don't you just stop there? Well, it makes sense when you look at the pictures, hopefully, but actually they made it too simple. The N here is 1. If they had used N of 2, which isn't as simple a number, it probably would make more sense to you the way it's drawn. But now I need you to think about mitosis, and specifically metaphase. What is the defining characteristic of metaphase? What happens that makes it metaphase? Well, they will be at the end of metaphase, but what do you? How do they get ready? Exactly. They're all halfway between the poles at metaphase. That's what defines metaphase. So even though it's not technically lining up, it's easier to just use that phrase. There's something that lines up in metaphase. That's true not only for mitosis, but for meiosis as well. And I didn't mention this yet, but both meiosis 1 and meiosis 2 have the same named subphases as mitosis. So there's prophase 1, prophase 2, and so on. Prophase 1 followed by prometaphase, followed by metaphase 1. You know, after you get through all the ones, then you have another set, all with Roman numeral 2s. So there's one lining up event in mitosis. That's just called metaphase. But there's a metaphase 1 for meiosis, and there's a metaphase 2 for meiosis. So there's two lining up events. Okay, now picture mitosis. And even though any ploidy of cell can enter mitosis, we studied it on the basis of a diploid cell. All right, so think about a diploid cell at metaphase of mitosis. How many, without me telling you what the species is, how many things line up in metaphase? For a diploid cell. What would be the general answer that would be true for all species, all sexual species?
Well, 23, right?
2N, exactly. It's not necessarily 23. I said for any species, not humans. When you use the variable, it would be for humans, but the answer for all diploid cells would be 2N, whatever N is. The point here is that in metaphase of mitosis, what line up are individual replicated chromosomes. Okay? In other words, there's a diploid cell, so there's, by definition, there's two number ones, two number twos, and so on for however many N. But in mitosis, in metaphase, the two number ones don't care where each other are. The two number twos don't care where each other are. It's individual ones lining up. That's why there's 2N different things lining up, not 1N. All right? Well, in metaphase 1, which is metaphase of meiosis 1, things line up, but it's not the same things that line up compared to mitosis. And this is the fundamental difference between the two. This is important to understand. What line up in metaphase one of meiosis are homologous pairs of chromosomes. And really, I should have been giving you that homologous definition back in slide two. Sorry about that. These two number ones that we see in detail here, they are said to be homologous to each other. That means they're the same kind. They're not identical, but they're both number ones. That's why they're homologous. The two number twos are homologous to each other, and so on. All right? So homologous means that they correspond to each other. Now, back in six, what we see lining up here, right before the meiosis one bar, which really represents the splitting part, what we see lining up here is not two N things, right? It's one N thing. And this is why it would have been easier if they'd used 2N as an example, or N of 2 as an example. This is one pair of homologous chromosomes lining up. If the N were 2, then it would look like this. That's one pair, and then another kind, which is shorter, is another pair. You see the difference there? But if it were N of 2 for mitosis, each of these would be lining up individually. See that difference? This is two N things lining up, mitosis. This is one N thing lining up. One N things lining up. But when N is one, one N is one thing total lining up. Now, the reason these are homologous is that they're the same kind of chromosome. And for an N of one species, it only has a type 1 chromosome. But this is a diploid cell, right? It has two number ones, and they are homologous to each other. The really important thing that happens in meiosis 1 is that before lining up, it actually occurs in prophase, as we'll see in better detail later. Each of the two homologs, the two number ones in this case, but it would be happening for the two number twos, the two number threes, and so on, for anything with a higher N, the homologs find each other and come together. That does not happen in mitosis. That's what I meant by saying that the two number ones don't care what each other are doing. They're acting individually. But they come together in meiosis. Meiosis 1. And therefore, what lines up in meiosis 1 during metaphase are pairs of homologous chromosomes. Now, each of these chromosomes is replicated, right? And so, in terms of chromatids, one pair of replicated homologous chromosomes involves four chromatids. Two on one homolog that are identical to each other. Two sister chromatids on the other homolog that are identical to each other. Four overall chromatids. And that's why another name for a homologous pair of replicated chromosomes is a tetrad, which simply means a four-part thing. So that's what line up, tetrads, in meiosis 1. And specifically, N of them. There are N tetrads that line up. Well, since different things line up in metaphase 1 of meiosis compared to metaphase of mitosis, that means the next phase, when the splitting occurs, involves splitting of different things in the two processes. So once again, think back to mitosis. What is it that split apart in anaphase of mitosis? Six sister chromatids, exactly. Right? That's the two sister chromatids are what make up one pair, one replicated chromosome. This is a sister chromatid, this is the other sister chromatid. We're talking about mitosis here. And when they split, we stop calling them chromatids when they're on their own, right? Now they are daughter chromosomes. Well, it wasn't individual replicated chromosomes, or it isn't, that line up in meiosis one. Instead, it's pairs of replicated chromosomes, homologous pairs, or tetrads. And therefore, what splits apart in anaphase one of meiosis is not sister chromatids from each other. Instead, the homologs separate from each other. The blue one separates from the red one. Okay? And make sense of why this right away results in a reduction in ploidy. The ploidy going into meiosis one is diploid here. Clear? Well, one of the two cells after the split is going to have just one of those number one chromosomes. The other one's going to have just one of those number one chromosomes. In other words, each of these two cells is already haploid. Each one has only one of each kind of chromosome. And if it were up here doing the splitting, then each cell would have a number one, one number one, and one number two. That's also haploid. Is this making sense? So that's where the necessary thing about meiosis occurs in meiosis one. That's when the reduction of ploidy occurs. Why then do you need to bother with meiosis two? What's the problem with these two cells that are produced at the end of meiosis one? Compare them to the cells that result at the end of mitosis. What's different about them? Well, yes, that is another important difference. But the difference I was asking for is that unlike the end products of mitosis, these cells still have replicated chromosomes. The sister chromatids have not yet separated from each other. That occurs in mitosis right away. It's the only thing that splits. Here we haven't split chromatids. We've separated homologs from each other. Each one is still replicated. Each one is still made up of two sister chromatids, which is enough for two cells. Each of these two cells has enough DNA for two cells, and therefore you need another round of splitting. Meiosis 2 solves that problem. And really, meiosis 2 is just like mitosis, except that you start with cells that are spit out by meiosis 1. These two cells individually enter meiosis 2. What lines up are individual replicated chromosomes. There's only one of them in each of these cells, but it would be higher for bigger ends. And then, just like in mitosis, chromatids separate from each other and get put into separate cells. So the final product of meiosis is not two cells, but four, because there's two rounds of division. Each cell is haploid because meiosis two does not change the ploidy, just like mitosis doesn't change it. It's already haploid coming into meiosis two. They remain haploid, but now they have just enough DNA for one cell because they've gotten rid of the replicated chromosome. They've split it into two individual chromosomes. All right? Everyone good with all the definitions? It's confusing at first, so tell me if not. Let's look at the details then. Slide 7 is a picture that looks very similar to the picture we looked at for mitosis. except that there's two parts to it corresponding to meiosis one and meiosis two. And I'm not going to go through every tiny detail because most of those details are the same for mitosis and meiosis. I'm going to focus on the differences between meiosis and mitosis. So what is the end that we're looking at here for this cell? N is 3. And if this were mitosis, there would be 2N or 6 things lining up. Okay? So just keep that in the back of your mind. But let's go back to the beginning. Prophase 1 involves a couple things that do not happen at all in mitosis. I've already mentioned this, but we can see it in pictures now. This is a diploid cell with an N of 3. Therefore, there's 6 overall chromosomes. But there's 3 homologous pairs of chromosomes. And so the first important thing that happens that doesn't happen in mitosis is that the two homologs for each type find each other wherever they are and come together. And that coming together of homologous chromosomes is called synapsis. Synapsis forms the tetrad. Until they actually come together, we don't call it a tetrad. The two chromosomes are homologous the whole time, but when they come together, then we call the whole thing a tetrad. Because it's four chromatids big. Okay, not only does synapsis occur, which is just bringing the two homologs together, but a very important event can occur. It doesn't actually have to, but it usually does. And that is called crossing over. So I need to pause for a second and tell you that there are 3 sources of increase in genetic variation that sex causes. And crossing over is the first of these 3 to happen. So let me just list the 3. The 3 sources of additional variation that sex causes are crossing over, then independent assortment, and then finally, random fertilization. Of those 3, the first one, crossing over, actually is responsible for by far most of the possible variation. But let's just look at what's happening here. You don't see great detail here, but you will later see better detail. Crossing over is well named because what happens when the two homologs come together is that 2 non-sister chromatids, meaning one of the blue chromatids and one of the red chromatids, which are not identical to each other, right? They came from different parents, will physically cross over at some point along their length. And that point of crossover is specifically called a chiasma, which is the singular word. Chiasmata is plural. And so you can see it actually happening twice here. 2 crossing overs for the same tetrad. But not only do they cross over at that point, but what makes it work as additional genetic variation is that they will swap information with each other. They'll swap the genes, the DNA sequence, with each other from that point to the tip. And so this thing that was totally blue coming into it will now be mostly blue with a little red, and the other one will be mostly red with a little blue. So right away, within this one parent, before there's any mating that occurs or before fertilization, there's already brand new sequences of DNA that have never existed, because this is a combination of this person's or this individual's 2 parental parents' DNA put into one chromosome. Do you see that? Because of crossing over? Okay, now about the number of... I said earlier that this accounts for most of the variation. And that's because of how many possible ways this can happen. You have to appreciate that a chromosome is millions of nucleotides long. And crossing over can occur just about anywhere along that length. So, when you think about it in terms of how many possible results there are just for one chromosome, it would be roughly 2 to the millionths of power, which is a ridiculously gigantic number. I mean, it just blows away the number of atoms in the entire universe. That's a tiny number compared to the number of possible ways crossing over can occur. And if you have it in an organism like us where n is 23, you then have to raise that to the 23rd power because it's happening in each one of these chromosomes. And so crossing over by itself drastically increases the number of possible gametes, which correspond to the number of possible offspring, genetically distinct from each other. You can think of it as a shuffling of cards, in a sense. You shuffle the deck with sex, and that's why you increase the variability. Not everyone gets the same hand. But the reason that I like that analogy is that crossing over wouldn't have any effect if it weren't for the fact that individuals have different DNA to begin with. If the two parents were genetically identical, crossing over wouldn't change anything, right? It would be swapping something for exactly that same thing. It's only if the non-sister chromatids that cross over are different from each other does shuffling matter. In the card deck analogy, you know, if you have a deck that is nothing but 10 of diamonds, you can shuffle it as many times as you want. Everyone's going to get a hand of 10 of diamonds. So what I'm saying here is that these three sources of amplified genetic variation that sex provides, those happen only because there are already different versions of DNA in the population. So that brings up the question of why is there already genetic variation in the population? What is the original source of all genetic variation? The only reason that we are not exact genetic copies of the first cells that are ancestors to everyone. What is it that happens that causes new versions of DNA to be created? Mutation. Mutation is the original source of all genetic variations, and sex would not make a bit of difference if it weren't for mutation creating new differences to begin with. All sex does is then take that variation that exists because of mutation and drastically amplifies it because of these mathematical possibilities. Yes, mutation is often accidental. And any sort of accident that results in a different sequence of DNA compared to what there was before is a mutation. Now, we don't consider it a mutation if crossing over occurs without error. But for instance, you could have it cross over so that they have unequal parts that they're swapping. And that would make it harder to survive, but maybe it's possible. The point, though, is that if there's no mutation to begin with, sex does not do anything at all. And it just complicates things because you have to involve two parents. Okay, so both synapsis and crossing over occur in prophase 1, not at all in mitosis. The two number ones do not come together. All right, now that we have N tetrads, remember N here is 3, that's why we have 3 tetrads. Each one is a pair of chromosomes. That's what line up, as I said, in metaphase 1. N tetrads, not two N individual chromosomes, but N pairs of chromosomes. And N here is 3. This brings us to the next source of genetic variation brought on by sex, which I said the second one was independent assortment. Well, we have to take this one word at a time. Assortment, just by itself, in this sense, refers to how a tetrad lines up at metaphase. So a tetrad is one blue and one red together, right? Or at least mostly red and mostly blue. But just think of it as a red half and a blue half. Well, each one has two ways it can line up. Red up, blue down, in this picture, since the poles are vertical. Or blue up and red down. One of those has to be true, right? But anyway, that's what assortment refers to just by itself. The whole phrase, independent assortment, refers to the important fact that how one tetrad in a cell lines up is totally independent of how other tetrads are lining up. In other words, each tetrad flips its own coin to determine whether it's going to be red up, blue down, or blue up, red down. If there were not independent assortment, then these would all be lining up blue in one direction, red in the other. That can occur, but it has to occur by flipping three heads instead of two heads and a tail, for instance. All right, so that's independent assortment. Now, this is still kind of a big number for humans because we have an N of 23, but just imagine an N of 1, first of all. Independent assortment doesn't really add anything because when you have only one tetrad, it doesn't matter whether it's red up or blue down. There's only one possibility. One cell's going to get red, one cell's going to get blue. But as soon as you have two or more, then independent assortment matters. And for an N of 2, there's going to be two possibilities. Both reds to one cell, both blues to another cell, or blue and red to one and red and blue to the other. Okay? And that's because for each of the two ways that the first one can line up, there's two that the second one can line up. So for an N of 2, it's two total possibilities. For 3, it would be 2 times 2. And so on. And in general, the number of ways that independent assortment can line up tetrads is 2 raised to the N minus 1 power. Notice that if N is 1, N minus 1 is 0, 2 to the 0th power is just 1. Well, for humans, N is 23, so 2 to the 22nd power, which I think is roughly 8 million. That means that just due to independent assortment itself, there's 8 million ways that tetrads can line up, and that corresponds to 8 million different possible gametes. And that seems like a big number, but 8 million is practically zero compared to the number of possible ways that earlier they can cross over. When you take this ridiculously huge number of possibilities for crossing over, you then have to multiply that huge number, which is almost infinity, by 8 million to make it even bigger.
Is that why it's like nobody that exists
anymore? Right. You could live a million years and have a child every year, and you wouldn't come close to having two that are the same as each other. I mean, you could go a billion years. No two are going to be alike because of the number of ways. Not that it's impossible, it's just so unlikely. So, and notice that no two parents have gotten together yet. This is happening just in one parent. So that there's 8 million times almost infinity different sperm that a male can make. There's an equally big number of eggs that a female could make. All right? And while we're on this, I might as well just finish up describing that third one, which is random fertilization. If you think about this in terms of card decks again, each parent has an almost infinite deck of cards to draw from. Those are the number of cards is the number of possible gametes that individual can make, which is almost infinity. Random fertilization refers to the fact that when fertilization occurs, one gamete from each parent is randomly drawn from that almost infinite deck. So the number of ways that you can choose one card from each of the two to make one unique zygote is almost infinity squared, which makes it even more ridiculously huge. But that's the only part that involves both parents. The other two sources of genetic variation that sex brings about occur in meiosis. All right? Well, anyway, let's go back and look at anaphase 1. It's the tetrads, not individual chromosomes, that line up. And therefore, what split apart in anaphase 1 are homologs from each other, not chromatids. Each homolog is still a replicated chromosome. And the two cells that are produced at the end of meiosis 1, along with cytokinesis, are now already haploid, because each cell has only one of each kind of chromosome. But they have replicated chromosomes still, because chromatids haven't separated from each other. And that's why you need the second round, meiosis 2, which is basically mitosis. What line up in metaphase 2 are individual replicated chromosomes, just like in mitosis. We don't even talk about homologous pairs anymore, because the homologs are in different cells at this point. They're never going to be together again. Okay, so this is an already haploid cell with replicated chromosomes, and those chromatids separate from each other in anaphase 2, just like they do in metaphase. That maintains the ploidy. You're going from a haploid cell with replicated chromosomes to two haploid cells with unreplicated chromosomes. And same thing for the other cells. So there's four overall cells. And the four cells are not only different genetically from the original cell, because for one thing, it's a different ploidy, right? But they're also different from each other. All four of them are different, because of crossing over an independent assortment. Now, that doesn't mean there's four possibilities. As I told you, there's almost infinite possibilities. So when another germline cell undergoes meiosis, it'll be four again, but totally different four. For the entire lifetime of the organism, they'll always be different. A typical human male produces several million sperm every day for several decades, and it doesn't come close to approaching the number of possible ones that could be produced if we lived long enough. By the way, this is why the only way you'd really do have genetically identical individuals is when an accident happens, which we call identical twins. Non-identical twins occur because two separate zygotes get formed from two different eggs being fertilized. Usually a woman will drop just one egg and only one gets fertilized. Well, if a single egg, which is normal, gets dropped and it gets fertilized, but then it splits in half because of some error, each one of those two zygotes is now identical to each other before they start dividing into two embryos and then fetuses and then babies. Okay, now slide 8 is really just a comparison, pictorial comparison of mitosis and meiosis. One thing that doesn't show you is that mitosis does not change the ploidy, and therefore any ploidy can enter mitosis. We're showing a diploid cell entering it here. But it could be a haploid cell, just like at the beginning of a fungus's life, right? It starts out as an individual haploid cell, which undergoes meiosis to become two haploid cells identical, and it grows up into a multicellular haploid adult fungus. So it doesn't have to be diploid to enter mitosis. It is here in this example, though. Now, for meiosis, it doesn't make sense for a haploid cell to enter it. You can't cut the ploidy in half when you're already at just one of each kind of chromosome. So it has to be diploid or higher. There are tetraploid cells and so on, especially in plants, but I said that I was going to mention two, haploid and diploid. So that's what we have here. N is the same for both of these cells. It's N is 3, and so the diploid cell is 2N, or 6 overall chromosomes. But in mitosis, there's only one division event, one lining up event, and there are 2N different things lining up, which are individual replicated chromosomes, whereas in meiosis 1, there are N pairs of things, N tetrads, lining up. Mitosis splits the chromatids, and you end up with two cells that are genetically identical to each other and genetically identical to the original cell. Mitosis just copies the cells. Meiosis involves both splits, though. So metaphase 1 is the lining up of the tetrads. Anaphase 1 is the separation of the homologs. That's where the reduction in ploidy occurs. These two cells are already haploid, but they both feature still replicated chromosomes, so they have to undergo meiosis 2 to split apart the chromatids, and you end up with four haploid cells that are non-identical and, of course, non-identical to the original cells, too. So that is probably the place to stop. Well, especially since 9 is just a summary. I do have a couple more slides, but we're almost done with that chapter.